I have one more speaker to invite to the stage tonight, Victor Minotti, Director of Environment and Trade at the International Forum of Globalization. Victor has been working on issues of free trade and around the environment for over 10 years now. He's the author of the IFG report, Free Trade, Free Logging, How the WTO Undermines Global Forest Conservation, and is currently working on a new report about globalization's impacts on indigenous peoples. Victor advises local international small fishermen's groups on trade policy and is on the boards of Just Act and the Ministerial, and today recently was named the lead plaintiff in the ACLU's lawsuit, Minotti versus Seattle, against the city's mayor and police chief for violating civil rights last November.
Good evening. I don't think anybody said it yet, so I will. Happy vernal equinox. And I say that to awaken in you your sense of Mother Earth, because I look at this battle over the resistance to FTAA is a struggle for Mother Earth, because there's a lot that's on the line here. I want to thank you, Jose, for your movie. It was really, really touching, and it makes me want to throw in my notes and start with a story about what somebody who it reminded me of. Is a Mexican campesino named Rodolfo Montiel Flores from Guerrero. Rodolfo was he's a landless farmer, and he led the resistance of his community of farmers and other communities in the hills north of Acapulco against Boise Cascade, one of the biggest U.S., in fact, one of the world's largest logging companies, who went to Mexico because of NAFTA. NAFTA made all sorts of changes in terms of what U.S. logging corporations could access in that country. I came in touch with them because with a Mexican colleague of mine at the Mexican Action Network on Free Trade, we've been trying to follow some of the U.S. logging companies who are investing in Mexico after NAFTA. And it was very difficult, just the information, but we knew that Boise Cascade had been there, and then we heard that they got kicked out, but we didn't know how. And so in February 1990, we went there, spent a few days going around the hills, talking to people. We went up, everybody said, you got to go talk to Rodolfo. Well, we went up to his community, you know, bumpy ride up to Sierra for 3 or 4 hours, and spoke with the community, and, you know, it was just a compelling story, because I'm sure a lot of you, I know people have been fighting Boise Cascade here in the U.S. for 10 or 20 years, and they haven't managed to kick them out of their communities. But somehow these campesinos managed to, and I wanted to know how. Well, basically the water in their from the forests above their fields was being cut off because of the terrible logging practices that were going on. And after a couple years, they writing letters to the authorities and sort of going through all the official channels, which only got Mexican federal soldiers put into their communities and sort of tagged them all as troublemakers. The community took direct action, and they shut down the roads. They blocked the roads where the logs were coming. And after a matter of time, Boise Cascade had no choice but to leave. And so they left. And it's a fantastic story. It's a great story of local resistance to a global corporation that, you know, very few people knew. And we wanted to be able to tell that story. But soon after we came back, I got a call at my desk from Rodolfo's wife. They had arrested him and thrown him in jail. This was a few months after I'd been there. And they beat the shit out of him. They tortured him, he and another friend. And maybe some of you have heard the story. It's been, you know, fairly covered in the press. But, you know, I didn't know how to get him out of jail. I'd never done anything like that. So I called some friends at Sierra Club and Amnesty International, and they've launched a pretty aggressive campaign to get him out. But the things that happened under NAFTA, you know, the changes to investment laws beforehand, foreigners could not own more than 49% of real estate or property in Mexico, and NAFTA changed all that. So when you hear about the FTAA or the NAFTA or the WTO talking about investment, that's what they're talking about. Who's going to get a control of those local community-controlled lands at this point? You know, the story that was told here about Mexican farmers, it also applies to people like Rodolfo. You know, they were basically not much more than subsistence farming. But what you have in those communities is because the liberalization of the opening of the borders to cheap American corn, people are being driven off their land. Those who have them may be turning to their forests to cut them down to supplement their income. And so you have a terrible problem right now in Mexico's forest that we're still trying to deepen our work on that. I tell this story about NAFTA and forests and the environment because we see how this stuff has worked, and there's a pretty clear record about, you know, how this model of free trade affects these sort of ecosystems and the people who depend on them for their livelihoods. And then, you know, the other piece so strong in about immigration. Just the other day, I got a call from Adolfo's brother-in-laws. He's got two brother-in-laws now up in Lake County pruning vineyards. You know, they've had to leave the community because there's nothing there, and they're calling me for work. You know, so if anybody knows anybody who has some job openings, let them know, because these guys are looking for work. But, you know, it's like what Kathy Tuck-Tockin was talking about from the National Network for Immigrant and Refugees Rights. You know, these are global economic refugees. These are NAFTA refugees. And that's how the issue is now being talked about. And I think it's important that we make all these connections in our local organizing and our international organizing. Now, to look at where this might go, expanding this model to the rest of the hemisphere, we know that our friends in Chile are very concerned about this. People who have been fighting for forest protection there for years, there are a lot of U.S. Logging companies invested there very heavily. They really have no forest protection legislation or enforcement capacity or anything, and they're saying that, you know, to expand that level of U.S. investment, to open up the few remaining restrictions they maybe have at this point to even more, would only accelerate that logging, and their ability to then pass new legislation would be virtually frozen by what Antonio was talking about. That's this investor state mechanism, which would allow any one of our U.S. companies invested there to sue Chile if they ever pass legislation that had anything to protect forests, because it would raise the cost of the logging companies, therefore reduce their profits, and they would demand the loss of those profits as compensation. But of course, that's the scenario of Chile coming under this expanded NAFTA model. The Mapuche people, one in 10 people in Chile are indigenous people, I'll call them the Mapuche. They've become very concerned also about this investor state idea because they're trying to get their land claims settled throughout many parts of the country. And if much of the land that they're claiming as their own traditional land, of course, is land that the government has auctioned off to foreign companies for logging. And if they're to get that land back, which they're trying to do, and there have been very many, they've been getting a lot of international support forcing the Chilean government to come to the table and give their land back, the Chilean government would now be forced to compensate the foreign logging companies for the lost income. So it puts a freeze on what the national government is able to do in terms of returning First Nations land back to the Mapuche. This is something that's also come up in British Columbia. And it's these existing provisions in NAFTA right now that are complicating these land settlement negotiations. One of many things, but it's a new issue that's come on people's radar screens. So the whole question of indigenous land struggles really gets complicated with this investment agenda too. Time? 1 minute. Okay, I'll stop, and I won't talk about Brazil. And I just wanted to share with people some of the information that we've been getting from our counterparts there. And to communicate to you all the level of resistance and organizing that's happening in those countries. I think a few weeks before Quebec City, Buenos Aires, is going to rock. I was down in Porto Alegre for the World Social Forum at the end of January, and almost every day there was something about FTAA organizing. And let me tell you, people there really understand it by what its original aim was, which was the Bush Initiative back in the early 90s. And when they put it that way, it they don't have to say much in terms of popular education. People get it right away. So, and they were talking about they want to make they want to have such a big action in Buenos Aires that they're going to make, how do you say, they're going to make Quebec be known as the Buenos Aires of the North. That's what's happened in Buenos Aires, sorry, is that just, thanks, just before the Quebec City meeting, which is the Summit of the Americas, where all the heads of state are getting together, their trade ministers are meeting in Buenos Aires, South Argentina, a few weeks before, the first weekend in April, the 6th and 7th. And there are going to be a lot of, they're going to fill the streets. The Southern Cone unions have already said they're going to put up to 80 to 100,000 people on the streets. That's twice the size of Seattle. That's what they were saying. Yeah. Now, that's what they were saying in Porto Alegre. And it's been hard to follow exactly how their local organizing has been going on since then. But I think there are things that we can try to do to support them. But I'll turn it back to Lauren and look forward to seeing people in the interactive workshops.